in this high-octane political moment, you get sucked into all the drama of it, it can be hard to step back and remember that there is policy being made. Policy that can shape how we run our households and make our budgets, go about our days. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And we start with a look at President Trump's executive order on welfare. It's called, quote, Reducing Poverty in America by Promoting Opportunity and Economic Mobility. LaDonna Pavetti from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities explains.
So the executive order basically is an order that instructs agencies within the government to review their policies, particularly around work, and to identify places where they can make changes or that they can propose legislative changes that could potentially be made to strengthen work requirements, among other things.
More from her in a moment, but this idea of attaching a work requirement to welfare access isn't new. Enter Larry Townsend. He was the head of the welfare department in Riverside County, California, back in the late 80s. His philosophy?
Get people into a job immediately.
Just don't worry about are you trained enough or do you have enough education. Just get that job.
We're not going to train you for years. We're not going to send you to school for years. We're going to show you how to find a job.
Townsend spoke with my colleague Chrissy Clark for our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, back in 2016, reflecting on 20 years of welfare reform. His program, GAIN, Greater Avenues for Independence, was all about moving people off of welfare and into a job, any job.
But at least your foot is in the door, and how well you succeed from there is up to you.
But there was a catch.
If you do not cooperate with us, we will take you off of welfare. Your children will still get money from us, but you won't.
Townsend's approach won much praise from welfare reformers and influenced the Clinton administration's Welfare to Work initiatives in 1996. In more recent years, Kansas and Maine have introduced similar programs, and according to a study from the Foundation for Government Accountability, work requirements work. But let's jump back to LaDonna Pavetti at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She questions the FGA's research and the White House's reliance on that data.
There's studies that have been done both on SNAP, which is the food assistance program, also known as food stamps, and on TANF, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And we had the same data that the Foundation for Government Accountability had. And just so you understand what they are claiming as success, 4 years later, there were basically 70% of the people who had left because of work requirements had either no income or had income below 50% of the poverty line. And 50% of the poverty line is basically $10,000 for a family of three. So we're talking about really low incomes or no incomes. And that, in our view, is not success. What you want is to really implement programs that will help people who already work but move in and out of work or work in very low wage jobs to move to better jobs. And work requirements have never been shown to do that. And they end up having a very large number of people who lose benefits and have nothing as a replacement. So our expectation is if we have very large numbers of people subject to those requirements, we will have lots of people who have no resources to put food in the on the table. If they lose their SNAP benefits, they will lose their health insurance, and they will lose their housing assistance. And those people will be people who are workers, they are people who have disabilities, and they are people who are caring for young kids.
You know, there is an example that my colleague Chrissy Clark did some great reporting on Riverside, California, in that county in the 1990s. And I guess I'm wondering, are there examples like Riverside of people successfully doing this, moving, you know, from welfare to work?
If you follow what happened in Riverside, there's two different stories. One is what happened in the early years of Riverside, and the other is what happens if you follow people over time. So in the very early years, what happened is you saw big increases in people going to work. But by the time you look at 5 years, pretty much all of those impacts go away. And the people who were not subject to those work requirements actually catch up. And there was a very small increase in earnings among people who were subject to them. The other thing that people don't really think about when they think about Riverside is what the cost of implementing that program was. So what happened is Riverside invested money. They invested money in actually hiring job developers. They actually did put some people into education and training. So in 2018 dollars, if you actually look at the cost per person of what Riverside cost, it was about $3,300 in today's dollars. If you look at it in the 1999 dollars, when those were originally, those expenses were calculated, it was about $2,000.
So per person?
Per person. So those costs are not costs that we have seen in estimates of what people are willing to spend on programs. The other program that was also very successful during those early years was in Portland, Oregon. And when you look at the cost there, it's even a bit higher, and that's about $4,000 and in today's dollars. So if we use those as examples of what we can accomplish, then we need to be ready to invest that amount of money. Otherwise, we are fooling ourselves to think that we can even get the short-term impacts that we got in Riverside and Portland if we plan to do this on the cheap.
You know, obviously, there was a big push to move towards stricter work requirements back in 1996 under President Clinton. That was something that, you know, had a fair amount of, frankly, bipartisan support at the time. Why do you think we are seeing this push for work requirements come back now?
So I think there's a couple of reasons. One is that we have seen a declining labor force participation, and so there is an interest in trying to find a scapegoat, and public benefit programs are that. There are many things going on in the labor market that really have contributed to changes in who's able to get work and how much people are able to work and how long they work. And so I think that that's part of what's fueling it. I think it is also an ideological battle going on. So I think there's lots of things that are contributing to that interest.
Presumably, there are some cost-saving arguments for this as well. Is there any sense that money would be saved with stricter work requirements?
The only way money would be saved is if you kick a lot of people off of the programs who are unlikely to find work. So it is not savings because people will to be doing better. So the arguments are often the language is used as we want to put people on a path to a better life or move out of poverty. And I've been doing this work for 20 years, and in 20 years, we have not seen people move out of poverty because of work requirements. What happened in the early years of welfare reform is that we saw initial increases in people going to work, and those faded by the end of 5 years. So that you just don't, the reality of what we know from what work requirements do does not square with what people claim they will do.
LaDonna Pavetti from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
For more reaction to President Trump's order, we called up a food bank in Washington State.
My name is Peggy Marash, and I'm executive director of Fish Community Food Bank in Ellensburg, Washington. Our food bank is nearly 50 years old. We are a food pantry as well as a food bank, and we have Open Table, which is a meals program. We serve lunch 3 days a week and dinner on Saturday evening. In our experience here at Fish, it's the children and the elderly who eventually feel the brunt of cuts and changes like this. Parents are struggling as it is, and when there are further cuts and further requirements put on them, it just makes their life more difficult and therefore makes the child's life more difficult. We have people who come into our pantry because they've had an issue in their lives, and when that, they want nothing more than to have that issue resolved and to be back at work, whatever caused them not to be working. So we because we are a small community, we have the opportunity to see people and understand their stories and know what caused them to be here and to celebrate with them when they no longer need to be here. I don't think there's anyone that we serve who really relishes the idea of asking for help.
That was Peggy Marash from the Fish Community Food Bank in Ellensburg, Washington. And we'd like to hear from you. What are the questions or thoughts you have about President Trump's welfare proposal? What could it mean for you and your family? Do you worry about it, or do you support the change and agree that work is the way out of poverty? Email us. We're weekend@marketplace.org, or call our voicemail, 1-800-648-5114. And later in the show, we look at the proposed farm bill and what it could mean for the food nutrition program, SNAP.